Today, the topic in part 27 of our series, The Story, is the resurrection as recounted in the Gospels. From the grief Jesus' followers felt upon his death, to the awe of the empty tomb, to their interpretation of the events on the road to Emmaus, to their final acceptance of Jesus' return and the Great Commission. Those events affect us all. Here's Pastor Seth.
It's easy to miss what you're not looking for, isn't it? When you read the accounts of the disciples on the morning of the resurrection and the women who are around Jesus, one of the things that's sort of stunning to me, was surprising to me when I first started reading this as a junior in college, was how slow the disciples were and the women were around Jesus to even believing the resurrection. And I remember thinking, but didn't they have hundreds of prophecies that the Old Testament, the rabbis taught them, and all the prophecies that came together in the life of Jesus? Didn't they have all those? And didn't Jesus, on five or six occasions that I can tell the disciples in detail that there's coming a day when I'm going to be arrested, flogged, crucified, and 3 days later rise from the dead? He did. And yet, on resurrection morning, not a person expected to see Jesus alive. Now, as you read the gospel stories, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, it's easy to read these stories sort of like a news release. How does Matthew's account dovetail with Mark's account? And how does Luke's account dovetail with John's account? And how does Mark and Luke, oh my gosh, would somebody just put together a timeline so I can understand what happened? You just kind of read this very dispassionately. Or you can read these accounts like a detective story. What did the disciples know, and when did they know it? What did the women know, and when did they know it? Perhaps it's better to understand the disciples and their response on the Sunday morning of resurrection if we can put ourselves back in their shoes. It was just a week before that Jesus and everybody had come into Jerusalem with the crowd, thousands waving palm branches and exclaiming, "Hosanna in the highest. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." The disciples and all the women around him mistakenly believed that he was going to become the physical king, the national king, and the hated Roman government would be somehow expelled, and Israel as a nation would be free again. That's what they thought a week before. And then just a few days before, they saw the unthinkable happen. That Jesus was arrested, and that he was flogged. And then some of them were around when they saw him hammered, his feet and his hands into a wooden cross. And then the unthinkable, to hang there for 6 hours and bleed out in the cruelest way man had invented in terms of execution, which makes waterboarding look like a treat. And here they are. Maybe if you've ever been to a funeral of somebody you loved, maybe it'd be good to put yourself back in their shoes. What's it like to lose somebody you love? It throws you into grief. What is it like to lose somebody that you love in the prime of life? That's a particular kind of grief. What is it like to lose somebody that you love in the prime of life to a very cruel and what looks like senseless death? That's another kind of grief. And for the disciples who had given up their careers, what's it like to give up your career and the vision that you have of a bright future and to have all of that shatter into 1,000 glass shards? All of those things were surrounding these particular folks over those days after his death. If you've never been in that kind of situation of grief, maybe it's hard to understand the disciples and how slow they were to believe the resurrection. But for some of you who have been through grief, this will not be a stretch. About a month ago, I wrote a poem about grief, and hopefully this will kind of put us back into the mindset and the emotional sense that the disciples and the women had after his death. A drive in a black hearse, gray cemetery stones, the living among the dead, a graveyard, of bones, a dark brown coffin covered with red roses, standing alone with death right under our noses, lamenting searing loss, dark shadows of grief, inconsolable pain. Is there any relief? Will this nightmare end? I'm hounded by doubt. Did my faith walk out the door? I just want to shout. Grief's a multi-headed, ogred monster, wearing costumes and masks, a conjurer. What character knocks at my door today? What script will grief read in my disconsolate fray? If I hear one more cliche, my head might explode. Haven't any of my friends traveled this road? You've got to move on. What lessons are you learning? Well, at least you have. Can't someone hear my yearning? I am weary with grieving. I hate this pain. Desolate days. Will I smile again? No more words to say. Just a deep-throated moan. Can the heart still talk through a long, sorrowed groan? Is this the valley of the shadow of death? Is this the place where I see your breath? What is it I need? Can you hug my soul? I look for the immortal in my heart's black hole. What was it like to watch your son suffer? When passersby scoffed, did your heart shudder? How is it possible to wait every hour, an agonizing death, watching evil devour? There are several people that I'd like to look at their experience of the resurrection. The first is Mary Magdalene. She was one of the first people on the scene that morning. She went with another woman named Mary. And when she got there, the two of them walked there. They were carrying a load of grief. The picture is something of Mary Magdalene sitting down. She was probably the most grateful person that I'm aware of that followed Jesus. She'd been taken out of a very broken life, given a new identity, a new forgiveness, a fresh start in life, a new heart. If anybody loved Jesus, it was her. And I imagine her getting there and sitting down just on the ground or maybe on a stone. And just weeping, just tears falling into her lap. And she hears somebody coming up behind her. She just assumes it's the gardener or the caretaker of the place where the tomb is. And we pick up the story here. She says, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have put him, and I will get him." We're not told even if she looked up. Verse 16, Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned toward him and cried out in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means teacher. Jesus said, "Do not hold on to me." She tried to reach out for him. "For I have not yet returned to the Father. Go instead to my brothers and tell them, I am returning to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." She goes running back to where the disciples were holed up in grief and in fear that they might be next on Pilate's list of execution, and she tells them she's seen the Lord, he's alive. And if you read the account, none of the disciples believe her. Peter and John take off and they run towards the empty tomb. That's about as close as they get at the beginning. In fact, what's pretty astounding is that nobody that I can tell believed that Jesus rose from the dead strictly by someone's testimony in the early days. It was only when you had only when you saw him with your eyes only that belief began. And eventually, testimony occurred. There are two other guys that I'd like to look at. They were disciples, not in the group of 12, but sort of that next ring of disciples out. And they were walking to a place called Emmaus, about a 7-mile walk. Now, when guys walk, it's different than when you ladies go on a walk. When you ladies go on a walk, it's my observation that you're really not looking where you're going so much as you're looking at each other. And there's something delightful about that. I love that. But when guys go on a hike together, it's sort of like going to the restroom together. Nobody really talks to each other. And the one thing you don't do is you don't make eye contact with another guy in a restroom. Bad idea. So I have that picture of these two guys who were also immersed in grief and shattered dreams. And they've got a 7-mile walk. And I just imagine each of them just kind of looking down at the ground, kind of mumbling to each other about the events of the past week. And the scriptures indicate that a third guy kind of walks up and joins the group. And I doubt there was any eye contact. They just talk. And apparently the stranger doesn't know what happened this past week. And so the two guys are giving him all the details. And after they give him all the details, Jesus realizes that these guys who should have gotten it don't get it either. In Luke 24, verse 15, this is how the story starts. As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them, but they were kept from recognizing him. Now, when you think of that, why would they be kept from recognizing him? And I think the rest of the story will answer that question. He said to them, after they told him all that had happened during the past week, he said to them, "How foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken." The problem is not a lack of evidence from Jesus' point of view. There was a truckload of evidence in the Old Testament. Hundreds of prophecies given, hundreds of prophecies fulfilled, all in this one man, Jesus. It should have been to somebody who was open-minded to what the Old Testament said to say, well, of course, duh, of course this happened. And maybe these guys would have thought, well, of course, Jesus told us all this is going to happen. But the problem is not a lack of evidence. How foolish and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. And then he gives them, these two guys, an Old Testament survey class as they're walking to Emmaus. Beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. It's not until they get to the end of their road and they decide to have a meal together that as they're sitting at the meal, suddenly they realize who the stranger is. And they forget the meal and they go running back to Jerusalem to tell the other disciples, he's alive. And now they can say, just like he said. Now, the most infamous about the people slow to come along and understand the resurrection was Thomas, a disciple, one of the 12. Mary had come, and after Peter and John ran to the tomb, at some point after that, in the place where the disciples were holed up, Jesus appeared in the room. And all the disciples are dumbfounded by this. They'd heard he was alive. Now they see him. They see him eating fish. They have a chance to touch him. This is not a figment of imagination or hallucination. This is really him. And suddenly, all of the prophecies and things that he had told them are now coming back into their mind, and they remember all this, and they're just ecstatic. Well, everybody's there except one. Thomas isn't there. When Thomas shows up later, and they all tell him, he's alive, it's true, then probably one of the greatest skeptics ever, Thomas, proceeds to earn a nickname that virtually everybody in the world knows. Just think if you had earned a nickname like this. Everybody knows Doubting Thomas. If he introduced himself by Thomas, maybe we wouldn't know who he is. And this is what he says to those guys. Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side where the spear went in, I will not believe. Quite a statement. The other disciples weren't too far behind on that. Jesus happened to show up to them. He hadn't yet to Thomas. He said, don't count on me in this. Maybe he showed up to you, but not to me. Well, a week passes, and Jesus shows up once again in the room. This time, Thomas is there. And Jesus says to him, he walks up to him and says, put your finger in my hand. Let me have your hand. Put it in my side. And suddenly, this great skeptic, doubting Thomas, says, "My Lord and my God." It took the resurrected Jesus standing in front of him to finally believe. Now, when I think about the resurrection, I think about what does that mean for us, particularly either as non-Christians, if you happen to be a non-Christian, or Christians. Well, when I think about if you're a non-Christian, I think the resurrection it should be pretty big evidence that there's something different about Christianity that you won't find anywhere else. Especially the fact of all the hundreds of prophecies that told this was going to happen, and Jesus' own words that this was going to happen. It's hard to wrap your mind around how do I explain this away? If you're a Christian, I'm going to address my words to the rest of you who are. What does it mean to live the resurrected life? What does this mean that because Christ rose from the dead, what influence should that have on our lives as we live our lives? And when I think about this, I think about that the disciples' experience is not unlike our human experience. In the world in which you and I live, there are, as far as I can tell, at least six aches, a groaning of the heart. Six things that are true about life that just cause you to just go, ugh. Paul talks about that all of us groan, that all creation groans. And I remember when I was a younger Christian, I thought, well, is he talking about all creation groans like a tsunami or a typhoon or a hurricane? Well, yes. I mean, we live in a fallen world and those things are true. But groan inwardly while we wait eagerly. This happens in the middle of Romans chapter 8. Where chapters 6, 7, and 8 aren't talking about creation in general. They're talking about the process of having our nature changed from sinner by nature to how does God form Christ in our lives through the course of this world. He's talking about people. And so when you hear that we groan inwardly, he's not creation groans. He's not talking about out there. He's talking about you and me. In our Christian world, I often hear the kind of teaching that sort of implies that if you're groaning about something, something's wrong with you. You're just not spiritual enough. Groaning is sort of implied that it's a problem to be solved. And if I'm just more spiritual and more committed, then I'm not going to have this groaning. And that belief sets a lot of people up for way more discouragement than is needed. Let me give you what I think are obvious six aches of the soul that are not going to be fixed this side of heaven. Number one, we live in a fallen world and where things just don't work like we know they should. And sometimes that's relationships. Sometimes that's your car. Sometimes that's your some appliance at home. Sometimes it's with your work. Miscommunications, misunderstandings, and those things just drive you nuts. And there's times when you just go, ugh. That's a groan. We live in a fallen world. Of course you're going to groan. Number two, we groan because I've done something stupid or sinful, and now I'm having to pay the price for that, or others are because of my foolishness. Sometimes as a Christian you think, how come I'm so slow to learn this? When am I ever going to be different? That's groan number two. Groan number three has to do with people around you. They do stupid stuff and they sin, and sometimes you get to experience the consequences of their bad choices. And you just go, ugh. Groan number three. Groan number four is the disciples and the women. Grief. Losing someone you love, care for, and having to sort of move on. That's a terrible phrase to use with people who've gone through or in the midst of grief. You never really move on from grief. You become a different person through grief. But grief, groaning number four. Groaning number five is this world is not our home. We are strangers and exiles here, the Bible tells us. One day when we're in heaven, we will be home. Until then, we experience a kind of groaning known as homesickness. I really want to be in a world where things are supposed to work like they should. And where relationships work like they should. We're not home yet. That's groan number five. Groan number six is God does purposefully with us, and it doesn't feel good, but it's a redemptive groan. And that you and I are going to groan every time that we put our real hope to feel better about our life in somebody or a group of people or some experience of life, and it doesn't happen, we're going to groan. And what that should open the door to is a deeper groaning that all of us have, that God has put into our hearts, a groaning for God himself. It's where we yearn for him. Groaning turns to yearning. That's number six. Now, number five and six are redemptive, good groanings. It feels terrible. But God is using those things until we get home, redemptively in our life. Number one groaning is inescapable. We live in a fallen world. So every day, as Christians, we and people too, we deal with, there are three groanings that you may hear in your soul every day. I live in a fallen world, a hunger for heaven, I'm not homesickness, and a yearning for God. Now, those three are in play all the time, whether you're aware of it or not. For the disciples, they were also experiencing groan number three, the sinful choices of others. They had that one going on, the Jewish leaders and the Roman authorities. And they had groan number four, which was grief. For those folks, they had, those guys, they had five different groanings all at the same time. Although in our experience, most of the time, all we can tell, we can't delineate these. We just say, I just feel so bad, and I'm so sick of feeling bad. That's groaning. Now, what's cool is Paul says we groan inwardly while we wait eagerly. We groan inwardly, meaning that's a fact. That's not a problem to be solved. That's just a fact about life that we're to recognize. And yet, what he says is it's meant to propel us to do something where he says we wait eagerly. We wait for the time when all of those groanings are going to be gone. The time when we're finally home. And I won't do any more foolish things, and you won't do any more foolish things, and I won't have any more grief or sadness or sorrow, and I won't have be homesick anymore because I'm home, and my yearning for God will be complete, and I won't live in a fallen world anymore. What he's talking about here is we live with hope. It's not the eradication of groaning. I groan, and I hope, he says. On the back of your handout, Paul talks about it this way in 2 Corinthians 4. This is a great illustration of this principle. We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus. What is he talking about? We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus. Well, we know that Paul had some experiences of near-death experiences out on the Mediterranean Sea, and sometimes having the living tar beat out of him and left for dead. But is that what he's talking about here? Or he's talking about a different kind of death? Because notice how he starts this verse off. We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus. Here what I hear him saying is that this is another way of talking about groaning, the reality of groaning. When he says we always do this, I hear him say every day. Don't be surprised if every day you have that sense of things are not right. And that sense of groaning. But notice what he says. So that the life of Jesus may also be revealed in our body. For we who are alive are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake. Of course you're going to groan, and so will I. And of course there'll be aches in the soul. Of course, Paul says. So that his life may be revealed in our mortal body. What's he saying here? In spite of the different kinds of groaning that you and I experience, this is not a problem to fix. It's a reality to accept. But what it does is it propels us to live with a sense of hope. That one day, all of the madness, all the disappointment, all the drama, all the messes and the conflicts and all the things that go wrong, all of that will finally be done. But in the meantime, my job is, in spite of the groanings and aches of my heart and the grief that I go through on any given day, my job is to give you, and your job is to give people out there a taste of what Jesus is like. You're an audiovisual of him. The life of Jesus comes through you, and it gives other people hope. One of the last things he said to them, to the disciples, comes at the very end of Matthew. And I love what he tells them. It illustrates what's important about living the resurrected life. He gives them three important things. The first is he reminds them of the upper story of God, the redemptive story of God that began even before Adam and Eve were created, all the way up to present. Jesus said to them, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me," meaning I am the author of this redemptive story, and it's gotten to this point today, and it's going to continue on because I am king, authority. I'm going to move this forward through human history. It acts like an anchor. I'm a part of a bigger story. In spite of the aches or the drama or the groaning that I have in my heart, in spite of all of that, there is still a story being told and that I can anchor myself to. The second thing is he gives them the mission. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations. That is, be engaged with the people in your world around you that don't know God. Make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe or to obey everything I have commanded you. In spite of my ache, in spite of my groaning, in spite of the hardship of life, God still wants to use your life and my life redemptively in the people he puts around you. That is the point. And the third thing, which I love, he gives them a word of hope. "Surely I am with you always to the very end of the age." Now, why is this important? Why didn't he just say, "Surely I am with you always," because he's talking to the 11 disciples here. "Surely I am with you always to the very end of your life." He could have said that. End of your life. If I'd been there, that's probably all that would have mattered to me. It's good that you're with me all the way to the end of the age. I already know that in heaven. It's good to know that through my life, well, he could have just said that. Well, what is he saying to these guys? As they're a part of the mission, and as you're a part of the mission, there are different images that we have in the New Testament. Sometimes we are the sower of seeds into people's lives by sharing God's word. Sometimes you are the dispenser of light, truth. Sometimes you are pouring out salt, salt shaker. You are a person of care and hope and mercy. The idea is, in all of these different metaphors, your life is being played out for the sake of others. Now, as you sow seeds into the lives of people, occasionally, it seems to me, you get a chance to see, oh, look, that little seed right there sprouted. It germinated. Oh, look, there's a bud. Oh, look, there's a flower there. Oh, that's cool. And you think about this person. And God has used you redemptively in this person's life. You think that's cool. Or you've displayed light, or you've done salt. And there are times when you see where God used that. You can see it, the effect of that. That's cool. But it's been my observation as a Christian of 44 years that there are, I don't know, 95% of the time, we don't have a chance to see the effect of our seed sowing, or our light emitting, or our salt shaking. Don't have a chance to see that. What happens with that? I think what happens is this. What he's saying here to the end of the age is, long after we put you in the ground, the seeds that you sowed, the light you emitted, the salt that you shook out for other people, I'm still going to be working with, even when you're in heaven. And there's going to come times as heaven moves forward where some of the people, you had no idea that they got anything out of the seed you sowed or light you emitted or salt that you shook out. Had no idea in real time back here that it made any difference at all until they show up in heaven. And what a rejoicing that's going to be when you put me in the ground. My ministry doesn't end with me in the ground. God just sort of goes, okay, hey, I got it from here. All the light, the salt, the sowing, until the end of the age, when history is wrapped up, your life will continue to make a difference. Now, I wrote a poem last fall that I'd like to finish with. And what it's going to require something of your imagination. I want you to imagine that you've died and you've gone to heaven and you are being taken, as Jesus said, to a mansion. He's gone to prepare a mansion for you. Now, I have no idea if this is true, but I'm partial to English mansions and English decor, outside and inside. Well, that's what I imagine when I think of this. And you are being taken there in a horse-drawn carriage. And there are people there that are waiting for you. They've gone on before you. And as you go, you're going to pass through some gardens. And you're going to see some flowers that are very unusual. Each one of those buds, each one of those little flowers, those blooms, each one is remarkably going to look like a face of somebody who's still alive back on planet Earth. That you knew, and you sowed seed with, and emitted light to, and sprinkled some salt into their life. This is called Mansions of the Lord. Do you see the faces of people you loved in the flower blooms of his gardens above? Clatter over the stone bridge. They all want to see you. Enter through the narrow gate this last time through. In the library, reading back through the old book. Obedience was worth it on every page you look. Paintings of people you loved. Portraits on walls, a crown of thorns, and crowns for you in all the halls. The hearth in the great room. Such rich decor, colorful tapestries, beauty galore. Golden candelabras, alive in flame, each candle lit when you shared his name. The drawing room filled, people full of life, because you gave your heart and shared your life. The banquet hall's ready, name cards in place. Each chair ready for someone you helped find grace. Reminiscing in the quiet drawing room. Victories won amidst what often looked like doom. Battles of yore and hard battles won. Times when you laid your desires down. Then the master of the manor walks in. Strides to the door, smiles because of joys you share and what's in store. Seeds sown, love shown in conversations that mattered. Our Redeemer God took broken hearts and made them untattered. Glad remembering, grateful recounting, grand realizing makes joyful singing. Filling every room and filling every heart. Let's pray together. If you're with us this morning and you think, I don't even know if I am a Christian. Maybe you thought you'd been one. But maybe suddenly you're questioning that and wonder if you really are. Or maybe you relate to the disciples who were so reluctant to believe what should have been, from Jesus' point of view, so evident, a mountain of evidence. Maybe you relate it to the part about so slow to believe and foolish. What was done on the cross was done for you. Sin, from God's point of view, a problem so heinous that the only solution that all of heaven could think of, and certainly no man did, was that the sinless Son of God would come to pay for sin, the innocent to die for the guilty, and for the risen Christ to come into the life of people and give them the life of Jesus over the course of this life. If you've never given your life to Jesus, all that God asks you to do is to humbly acknowledge what should be patently evident. I am a sinner by nature. I am committed to me first. I make messes wherever I go. There's something wrong inside of me that I cannot fix. This is the good news of the gospel. Instead of you or me coming up with a solution, God came up with a solution and offers it to you and me, to simply take him up on the incredible gift of his Son in your behalf. Father, for those of us who are Christians, who are aware of an ache in the soul, and who are secondly aware that no matter how hard I try, I cannot extricate that ache, today is also a day of good news. The ache in the soul is not a problem to solve. It's a reality to embrace. But it leads me to you and to hope and to anchor myself in something different than what I've anchored myself in up until this moment. The point is not my ache. The point is, in spite of my ache, you want to use my life with the people around me. Give us that vision as your people.
We at Pacific Church of Irvine invite you to join us every Sunday at 9:30. You can also visit our website at pacificchurch.com.